Welcome to More in the Word, a podcast of More Theological College in Sydney, Australia, that seeks to glorify God through biblically sound, thought-provoking, and challenging talks and interviews. In this episode, and in honour of More Theological College's 170th anniversary, we bring you a second special episode, taken from the 2025 Donald Robinson Library Lectures on the topic of the Clapham Sect and their influence on Sydney. Michael Gladwin, lecturer in history at St. Mark's National Theological Centre in the School of Theology at Charles Sturt University, examines the role of John Newton. Newton was the author of the hymn Amazing Grace and a former slave trader turned pastor, and he served as both architect and encourager of the first Anglican mission in Australia. Through Newton's correspondence and networks, Michael shows how Newton's theological depth, pastoral wisdom, and missionary foresight influenced the birth of evangelical Anglicanism in the Southern Hemisphere. We hope you find the episode helpful. Please note, this episode is a companion to last week's episode, in which Mark Thompson tells the story of how Richard Johnson became the first chaplain to the colony in New South Wales and shaped gospel ministry in early Australia. If you missed that one, I encourage you to go back and listen.
On the 8th of July, 1777, the portly Reverend John Newton retired to his rectory study to put quill to parchment in his diary. In the entry, he confessed to binge reading the latest bestseller. This book that had so engrossed him was a publishing sensation, Captain James Cook's three-volume Voyage Towards the South Pole and Round the World, published in that same year. It caught Newton's imagination, but clearly it also caught his evangelical heart. "My leisure time, and rather more than I can well spare," he wrote, "taken up with reading the accounts of the late voyage of Captain Cook in the Southern Ocean and round the globe." But then he moved to prayer in his diary entry. "Teach me to see thy hand and read thy name in these relations. Thy providence and goodness are displayed in every clime. May I be suitably affected with the case of the countless thousands of my fellow creatures who know thee not, nor have opportunities of knowing thee." He continued, "Alas, those that are called Christians, who venture through the greatest dangers to explore unknown regions, should only impart to the inhabitants examples of sin and occasions of mischief, and communicate nothing of thy gospel to them. Lord, hast thou not a time for these poor benighted souls, when thou wilt arise and shine upon them?" Well, I wondered if he, as he penned those words, whether he thought about himself as a former slave trader and the impact he'd had on some of the places and people that he'd visited. Well, Newton didn't know it then, but his Lord did have a time and a plan for those souls. And within the short space of 7 years, Newton would be at the center of that plan. And we've heard a little bit of that from Mark in the previous paper. Newton would be crucial to launching the first Christian mission and Anglican church in Australia. Well, the focus of my paper is on the part that Newton played in that audacious endeavor. And I'll argue that he played two key roles. First, he was a mastermind of the Australian mission in his strategic networking with well-placed evangelicals to recruit, prepare, and fund clergy. And second, and this is where the weight of my paper is going to be, he was mentor of the missionary through letters to Richard Johnson that reveal a pastor's heart, a judicious combination of pragmatism, professional supervision, and pastoral care, and plays a key role in sustaining Johnson and sustaining the mission. In terms of sources, I'm drawing on Newton's diaries, on the eclectic society notes that Mark mentioned earlier, and his voluminous correspondence. But a particular focus is on the letters to Richard Johnson in the crucial pioneering years between 1787 and 1795. I don't have space today to detail Newton's biography, obviously, in 20 minutes. For that, I refer you to D. Bruce Hindmarsh's seminal John Newton and the English Evangelical Tradition. If there's one book to read on Newton, it would be that. The more popular version is on the right there, called Amazing Grace. And the book in the middle there is a reprint of the very famous autobiography that Newton wrote about his life, an authentic narrative, but it also talks about his spirituality and particularly his gift for letter writing and friendship Well, let me begin with a mise-en-scène to Newton's life. If anyone can lay claim to a storied life, it's Newton. Before his conversion in a storm at sea in 1748, he'd experienced years on slave trade ships, being press-ganged into the Navy. He'd been whipped, and he experienced servitude on a Caribbean slave plantation. After his conversion came marriage and settling down, and a later call to the ministry, with 16 years as the curate of Olney, a small market town in Buckinghamshire. From this base in parish ministry, Newton soon gained a reputation as a down-to-earth preacher, a hymn writer and poet, and above all, a writer of spiritual letters, many collections of which were published in his lifetime. Fast forward to 1783, and Newton was now in charge of St. Mary Woolnoth, a fashionable English Baroque city church in the heart of the City of London's financial district. It was from this London base, as Mark noted before, and through Newton's genius for deep friendship, for spiritual direction, and for forming associations of evangelicals, that Newton masterminded the mission to Australia. Crucial to this was the founding of the Eclectic Society in 1783, a tea-drinking Georgian theological think tank, perhaps. And these kinds of associations reflected a thriving associational culture that was developing in 18th century Georgian Britain. Well, we've heard already that 2 years later, William Wilberforce was knocking on Newton's door as he wrestled through to an evangelical conversion and a political vocation. That revolving door included Clapham sect members and their associates, such as Charles Simeon, Hannah Moore, Richard Cecil. One of those co-founders of the Eclectic Society we've already been introduced to briefly today was the Reverend Henry Foster. And we saw how he introduced Johnston to Newton. Johnston was the curate of Foster around this time by the mid-1780s. And I can't help thinking he looks a little bit like an 18th century Justin Brierley. "Well, yesterday I put Mr. Johnston in my pulpit," writes Newton, who I think gives us an earnest of a judicious, good preacher. At the same time, as Mark recounted, the British government was making plans for the penal settlement in New Holland. And it's in these years, 1785 and 86, that the plans coalesce. And we've heard from Mark the story of William Pitt's good friend of Wilberforce organizing for a chaplain. And it's Newton who provides the name. It's philanthropist John Thornton, we've already heard too, who took Johnston to a hulk to meet his new parishioners. And it's 2 days after that that the royal warrant for the chaplain is signed. But I want to just point to Newton's networking efforts that continue over the next decade. It begins with Johnston. He introduces Johnston to Moravian missionaries who've had much more experience than most Protestants in missionary endeavor, going back about two centuries. With help from Thornton, he also enrolls evangelical banker Ambrose Martin for fundraising for about the equivalent of an annual salary for Johnston to keep him in with expenses before he goes. There's a decent waiting time of several months. He also gets in touch with the evangelical comptroller of the Navy, Sir Charles Middleton. We've heard a little bit about him earlier from Stuart, and raises the equivalent of this annual salary. And that covers the expenses of Johnston, and then they need to find extra expenses for his new wife, Mary, whom we've heard about. Well, in the early years of the mission, we also find Newton seeking political advice from evangelicals such as Ambrose Searle, who was in the Board of Trade. We also find him asking for help recruiting a second clergyman with letters to another influential evangelical, Charles Grant, the director of the powerful East India Company. And of course, success would come after several false starts in the form of Samuel Marsden in 1794. The final practical role that we see Newton in these years is the editing, production, and distribution of that first fruit of Australian publishing, Johnston's Address to the Inhabitants, a tract that he'd written to reach the population he couldn't get to physically. Newton helped edit the tract And we find in his letters, he's tactfully redacting sections that seem too querulous politically. But Newton also transcribed it for the press. He organized its printing. He also undertook responsibility to cover the cost shortfall, reckoning it would not sell enough copies to cover the printing costs. So we've seen something of Newton's networking and friendship genius and his role as mastermind, beginning in prayer and then talent scouting and funding the fledgling Australian mission or organizing for that. But a second role that emerges from Newton's writings is that of mentor. And it's here that we see Newton practicing what he would become most famous and beloved for, his postal epistolary ministry. His numerous letters to Johnson reveal him as a pragmatist, as a professional supervisor, and as a pastoral carer for the soul. These letters are pervaded by a spirit of warmth, but frankness and practical wisdom. And one thing to note with this correspondence is that it took 8 months for a letter to get to Sydney and then another 8 months for it to get back to London. So it's about 1.5 years before you get a reply to your question or your comments. And there's not a neat tennis match of letters. They don't always overlap. Sometimes the letters didn't get to Johnson or to Newton. So it's a little bit patchy with the Royal Mail in these early years. In the first place, much of the advice in these letters is intensely practical. Newton knew better than anyone else the terrors of ocean travel and the rigors of that travel in these days. And he added in one of his first letters that Paul's sea travels in the book of Acts would, quote, have peculiar weights, and you will feel comfort from them, which you have never felt before. He also talked about a change of climate and of diet that will try your constitution. Nothing can hurt you while the Lord is with you, he reminded him, but he had to be pragmatic. It would be madness in you to risk your health by going down into the hold of a ship where the air must always be putrid from the breath of a crowd of passengers in chains. And I couldn't help but wonder if, as he penned this, the former slave trader was picturing in his mind's eye the wretched human cargo in the holds of slave ships he'd commanded. Newton added, if they're sick and want you, let them be brought up on the deck. It will be equal folly to venture your life among the savage natives on shore before their confidence is obtained by the mutual good offices of others, in other words, the military. Remember, your business is religion, mind that and that only, and be careful of your health. Well, Johnson, for his part, would completely ignore both bits of those advice, particularly going down into the holds of the Second Fleet and ministering to those wretched, sick and dying. Well, having been in the Navy, having lived on several isolated British colonies, Newton could also advise on how to manage upwards and downwards. He wrote in May 1788, your success and influence will not depend much upon the manner in which you express yourself, as upon the general impression which your character makes upon the people you're with. If Captain Philip, the officers, seamen, and convicts, conceive of you as devoted to God, firm in his cause, meek, humble, and compliant in all cases where conscience is not concerned, and at the same time as standing upon higher ground than to be influenced by the fear of man, or of any danger or hardship to which duty may expose you, this will give a weight to what you say. But I believe you will have sharp trials and be at times like the sailors in a storm, almost at your wit's end. And that prophecy was correct. Those sharp trials certainly came, and we've heard something of those in Mark's paper in the first 8 years. Johnson protested more than once to Newton that his treatment did not befit a gentleman, a chaplain, or a clergyman. The hostility and exclusion must have stung harder because Johnson had come from a genteel, provincial background. And this is a period in which manners were marked by a strong emphasis on that key criterion of social worth and standing for the 18th century Briton and clergyman, gentility. Being a gentleman implied certain moral qualities, honor, courage, consideration for others, embodied in a fairly strict code of what was done and not done, as well as voluntary public service. And in return, the gentleman expected immense respect and the authority and privileges that were due to them. Well, Newton's responses reflect a social shift that Stuart alluded to earlier, in which evangelicals were transposing gentility into a distinctly Christian key. These gentle rebukes and exhortations in Newton's letters, particularly to dignified silence, reflect recognition that the gospel itself would bring offense as well. In one letter, Newton wrote that, "I think you likewise laid too much stress upon your office as chaplain and the right you had from thence to be considered and treated as a gentleman." On another, he reiterated, "I believe what you've heard of your name being treated with ridicule here, but be it true or false, more or less, I thought it would be acting below yourself to take notice of it. Your character is too well established to be in the least affected by such trifles, and as a minister and a Christian, you will do well to pass by them with silence." Another letter, he even writes a fable to drive the point home in a more poetic way. The fable says that on a fine night, a parcel of dogs thought proper to bark and howl violently at the moon. But the moon, well satisfied that they could not hurt her, replied with great composure, "You may make what noise you please, but I am determined that I will shine on." I think the moral is obvious and good, Newton concluded. Well, in letter after letter, Newton reminds Johnson of his high missionary vocation and the nobility of that vocation, seeking to fan back into flame the missionary spirit that he discerned in Johnson back in England. And you see him trying to strengthen a bruised reed that is at risk of breaking. A familiar refrain is the stubborn providential optimism that was such an impetus to missionary endeavor in this period. "What design government may have in forming your settlement, I know not. I approve the extension of our commerce, but I trust the Lord designs to make this place subservient to his gracious design of spreading the lights of his glorious gospel." In 1791, having news of the near starvation of the colony and Johnson's discouragement, Newton urges the long view, as well as the importance of seeking to be faithful rather than successful. "I've not been disheartened by your apparent wants of success. I've been told that skillful gardeners will undertake to sow and raise a salad for dinner in the short time while the meat is roasting. But no gardener can raise oaks with such expedition. You are sent to New Holland not to sow salad seeds, but to plant acorns. And your labor will not be lost, though the first appearances may be very small and the progress very slow. You are, I trust, planting for the next century. I have a good hope that your oaks will one day spring up and flourish and produce other acorns, which in due time will take root and spread among the islands and nations in the Southern Ocean." That theme of faithfulness over success is a constant refrain in the letters. Well, other letters capture Newton's practical and professional wisdom about ministry priorities in a pioneer colony. Newton began by reminding Johnson of God's care for him in one of his letters. "As a friend, I'll offer you two or three thoughts which occurred to me while I was reading your journal. I do not wonder, nor can I blame you, that you often felt cares and anxieties respecting your temporal concerns. If we're in the path of duty and in the use of proper means, such cares are indeed needless, because the Lord careth for us. But when you speak of time spent in your necessary employment as so much lost time, because it kept you from your books and studies, I think you distressed yourself without just cause. I wish you to consider your mission as a whole, composed of various parts, each of which, in its proper place, has its importance. Preaching, reading, and study, etc., are of the first consideration." But Newton then pivots to advice on sanctified secular pursuits. "But I believe the apostle was employed no less lawfully and properly when gathering sticks for the fire, Acts 28:3, than when preaching the gospel. You understand the gospel too well to confine religion to devotional exercises. The secret of the Lord teaches us, whether we eat or drink, or whatsoever we do, to do all to his glory. I judge that when you dig in your garden or plant potatoes or cabbages, you serve the Lord as truly as when you are upon your knees or in the pulpit, provided you do these things in a right spirit, in dependence upon him, and in submission to his will. Such employments are a cross to our inclinations. But if we take them up as a cross and can cheerfully deny our own will, they become, when necessary, part of the obedience we owe him. Well, Johnson was, after all, deemed the best farmer in the colony, had success with fruit orchards and vegetables, wheat and barley and flocks. And it's still a delicious irony of Australian history that our wine and tobacco industries were begun by a clergyman with Methodist associations. Perhaps when you have a glass of wine with lunch, you can raise that and thank Newton for encouraging those industries. Well, practical ministry advice extended to preaching across several letters. Newton hoped in an early letter that Johnson wouldn't confine himself to moral subjects. We heard Mark's quote on that a little bit earlier. Years later, he reminded Johnson that only the Holy Spirit could touch the hearts such as those of many convicts, and he shouldn't be discouraged about the lack of results. Yet the old preacher also wondered if an emphasis on preaching grace and mercy rather than law and judgment might better suit the majority of Johnson's literally captive audience. You often speak of preaching awfully. Undoubtedly, a declaration of the law and the penalty due to transgressors is a part of our message. To persons in this state, denunciations of wrath too frequently repeated, instead of working savingly upon them, rather tends to increase the enmity of their minds against God. Well, before I finish, just a brief comment on style. We've already seen in some of these quotes the different kinds of metaphors that he uses. These are sowing salad seeds, planting acorn trees for oaks, gesture towards his style, this use of homespun, pungent images with biblical, nautical, and nature-oriented themes. Johnson, for example, was carrying a spark from which to enlighten the whole Southern Hemisphere. Port Jackson was the spot from whence the gospel light may hereafter spread in all directions. Multitudes may rejoice in it who are at present covered with a thick darkness. And Johnson was a sailor, as we heard in that poem, on tempest-tossed seas and savage shores. He writes to him in blank verse as well. Well, to conclude, we've seen how Newton's letters, and particularly his letters to Johnson, cast fresh new light on Newton's role in the Australian mission. We've also seen how he acted as a mission mastermind in prayer, study, and in fostering evangelical associational culture. In his Clapham-like use of evangelical networks in the banks, in the Colonial Office, the Board of Trade, the Navy, and the East India Company. He epitomizes what my friend Gareth Atkins has so brilliantly described, and which Stuart alluded to this morning in his book, Converting Britannia, how evangelicals use networks of family, of friendship, patronage, and place in every sphere of British public life to forward missional aims. And we've also seen how Newton mentored the missionary. It's impossible to assess the full impact on Johnson of these friendly epistles of practical wisdom, professional advice, and pastoral care. That will await conversations with Johnson in heaven. But something of the letter's impact can be gauged by the fact that the correspondence with Newton peters out after 1795, and that coincides with the arrival of Governor Hunter, with the full backing of a sympathetic Christian governor after 1795, life becomes immensely easier for Johnson. For Newton, it was perhaps like the euthanasia of a mission. The next letter is not till 1800. Well, Newton's Australian epistolary mentoring resonates with other assessments of his work. J.I. Packer has observed, Whitfield was flamboyant, Wesley was masterful, Newton was unobtrusive. Yet Newton was indubitably one of the three greatest 18th century evangelical leaders. As a warm-hearted pastoral counselor, in groups and by letter, he had no peer. His best biographer notes that Newton's published letters are classics of evangelical spirituality. Hindmarsh adds that Newton's life story, his parish ministry and practice of spiritual direction, and the integrity of his personal relationships make him a trustworthy guide to the spiritual life today. And so today we mark the 300th anniversary of Newton's birth, and we ponder his and his friend's legacy for the Australian church. And it seems fitting to end with Newton's last extant words to Johnston. They're warm and personal like his letters, but they have the poignant tone of an elegy. They're a farewell, and yet they're imbued with a stubborn, prophetic hope. Newton did not see the fruit of the seed he was sowing, but we stand here as grateful beneficiaries of that. And no one more than I who encountered the living God in an Anglican church, a Newtonian oak branch, in 1993. Newton writes, "You have dropped me of late years, and therefore I make the less apology for dropping you. At the age of 75 and with increasing engagements, I cannot write much. Give our love to Mrs. Johnson, Milba, Ambrose, and the rest, if the Lord has given you more. May the Lord bless you all, you and your children, and may the good seed you are sowing spring up to flourish for ages. Notwithstanding the discouragements you've met with, I am persuaded the Lord has not sent you so far to labor in vain." Thank you.
Thank you for listening to More in the Word, a podcast of More Theological College. Our vision as a college is to see God glorified by men and women living for and proclaiming Jesus Christ, growing healthy churches, and reaching the lost. In 2026, More College is giving thanks to God for His faithfulness over 170 years. Please join us in praying for the college, and if you're in Sydney, please consider coming along to one of our events. The Samuel Marsden Archives is the digital repository and archives catalogue of More Theological College and contains materials related to the college, evangelicalism in Australia, and Christian theology extending all the way back to 1651. The archives include manuscripts, books, photographs, and audio recordings by significant people, past and present, digital media and resources produced by the college, and theses by More College students. To find out more, to research a topic, and to explore, head to archives.more.edu.au. That's archives.more.edu.au. It is our hope and prayer that the archives will benefit, edify, and encourage the wider Christian community in Sydney and beyond. You can find out more and register by going to the More College website, More, that's M-O-O-R-E, .edu.au. If you have not already done so, we encourage you to subscribe to our podcast through your favourite podcast platform so that you'll never miss an episode. For past episodes, further resources, and to make a tax-deductible donation to support the work of the college and its mission, please visit our website at more, that's M-O-O-R-E, .edu.au. If you found this episode helpful, please share it with a friend and leave a review on your platform of choice. We always benefit from feedback from our listeners, so if you'd like to get in touch, you can email us at comms, that's C-O-M-M-S, at more.edu.au. The More in the Word podcast was edited and produced by me, Karen Bielhartz, and the communications team at More Theological College. The music for our podcast was provided by Mark July from Pixabay. Until next time.